It's always fun, isn't it, being the bearer of exciting news? It's a rare occurrence, of course, in the age of social media. These days you announce that a couple are engaged, or that a baby has been born, or that an exam has been passed, only to be met with bored expressions. It's already been circulated on Facebook or on Instagram. It's old news now. But of course, in Luke chapter 24, it's the first century AD, and there is no Facebook, and there is no Instagram. And a man called Cleopas, along with his wife or his friend possibly, is striding out towards Jerusalem. The two of them have some news for Jesus' disciples. It's utterly sensational news. It's earth-shattering news. They can announce that Jesus, who a couple of days earlier had been killed and buried, they can announce that Jesus is alive again. And doubtless then they're relishing this announcement, the gasps that it will produce, the sheer wide-eyed amazement. Perhaps they're laughing about it together in anticipation. There are no smartphones in the disciples' pockets to spoil the surprise. No tweets or notifications can preempt Cleopas's news. These two residents of Emmaus are going to shape the disciples' world with their revelation. And so, arriving eventually in Jerusalem, they rush to the room where they know the disciples will be. They burst in through the door. "Guys," they shout, "we've something to tell you." But they don't get any further with their announcement than that, because they are instantly hit by a wave of excitement and energy every bit as great as their own. The atmosphere in that room is electric. The place is pulsating. And as Cleopas and his companion try to take it all in, they begin to pick up a line that keeps being uttered. "The Lord has risen indeed and has appeared to Simon." The Lord has risen indeed and has appeared to Simon. And suddenly the penny drops. This news, which they have rushed 7 miles to proclaim, the disciples already know. They already know that Jesus is alive. And it's that line then that's circulating joyously around this room of disciples. "The Lord has risen indeed and has appeared to Simon." It's that line that I want us to consider this morning. You'll find it in verse 34 of Luke chapter 24. And there are three things in it that I want to highlight. And first of all then, the decisive incident. The decisive incident. So I've talked about this walk by Cleopas and his companion, this 7 mile walk from a village called Emmaus to the city of Jerusalem, this walk that's all about telling Jesus' disciples he's alive. Now, I suspect most of us would regard it as quite a strenuous day, wouldn't we, if we'd managed a 7 mile walk. On this day, however, Cleopas and his companion have done at least two of those. Because as they arrive in Jerusalem, intent on finding these disciples, that's not the first time that they've been in the city this day. They'd been there just a few hours earlier. Indeed, they had been with these very same disciples a few hours earlier. And this is the thing that I'm interested in. When they had been with the disciples earlier that day in Jerusalem, the mood then had been completely different. It had been subdued. It had been downbeat. It had been cheerless. There was no electricity in the atmosphere then. There was no wave of excitement and energy then. Indeed, Cleopas and his companion had taken that somber mood with them as they had left Jerusalem a few hours earlier, so that partway into their journey, they had stood still at one point, looking sad, verse 17. Why? Why all that gloom at that point? Well, I hear you say, that's easy, Dan. At that point, they thought Jesus was dead. And that's true. But why at that point did they think Jesus was dead? Well, because, you might reply, they had no reason to think otherwise. All the evidence pointed to him being dead. But actually, that's not true. When Cleopas and his companion departed Jerusalem, probably at some point during the afternoon, amid such gloom and despondency, they and the disciples already knew two pieces of evidence that pointed to Jesus not being dead. Number one, there was the women's report of an encounter that morning with angels. Angels who had said quite explicitly, he is not here, but has risen. And then number two, there was Peter's discovery of Jesus' vacant tomb and of the discarded grave clothes. The disciples knew of those two developments. Cleopas and his companion knew of those two developments. They talk about them to the man that they meet on the road. Verse 22, moreover, some women of our company amazed us. They were at the tomb early in the morning, and when they did not find his body, they came back, saying that they had even seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Verse 24, some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said. So they knew these two pieces of evidence. They knew about the women's report. They knew about Peter's discovery of the empty tomb. So why then, I'm asking, was everyone so sad? Why this unquestioned assumption that Jesus was still dead when they had these two quite striking pieces of evidence? Why was nobody at that point thinking in terms of resurrection? And the answer is, those pieces of evidence weren't anything like enough to satisfy them. Why not? What did they need then? What did they need to conclude that Jesus had risen? What would it take to convince these people that Jesus had risen from the dead? Well, our text, verse 34, tells us, the Lord has risen indeed and has appeared. That's the thing. Jesus had to be seen. You can tell that, can't you, from what Cleopas and his companion say at the end of verse 24 there. But him they did not see. The women, they saw angels, they said. Peter, he saw an empty tomb, but him they did not see. The lack of a sighting, as far as these people are concerned, makes everything else irrelevant. The women's report was irrelevant. Peter's discovery was irrelevant. Jesus actually had to appear. He had to be seen. If he hadn't appeared to anyone, then as far as they were all concerned, he was still dead. The women's report must be an idle tale, verse 11. Peter's discovery must point to some kind of foul play that had taken place. Jesus hadn't appeared. That was the crucial thing. He hadn't appeared. These other strange phenomena that had happened, they were just minor distractions from that central, depressing reality. Jesus hadn't appeared. And I'm stressing this then, because I think it's very, very important. You see, perhaps this morning, you don't believe that Jesus literally, bodily rose from the dead. And your attitude then to the disciples and the other Christians who were so adamant that Jesus had risen, your attitude perhaps goes something like this. Well, people were just naive and gullible back then. They lacked our scientific mindset. They would have found it all too easy to swallow the idea that a man had risen from the dead. Well, if that is your attitude, I'm afraid your thinking is flawed. It's true, of course, that science has advanced over the last 2,000 years. It's true that in the first century AD, penicillin hadn't been discovered, and Einstein's theory of relativity wasn't known. But people had enough scientific knowledge to appreciate that dead people stay dead. They knew that. Hence, they had funerals, and they were big on mourning, and they wrote wills, all the same kind of stuff that we do in the face of death, because they knew the finality of this event. If you'd asked a first century person what happens to a body after death, he or she would have told you about the process of decomposition. And if you'd probed a bit and said, yes, but sometimes does a body come back to life again? The person would have looked at you like you were some kind of lunatic. I'm saying they didn't find the idea that a man had risen from the dead any easier to swallow than we do. And we see that here in Luke 24. These people didn't find it easy to swallow that Jesus had risen from the dead. They'd seen Jesus do miracles for 3 years. They'd seen him walk on water. They'd seen him heal people. They'd seen him raise dead people. But they still didn't find it easy to swallow the idea that he had risen from the dead. They hear that some women have had an encounter with angels at the tomb. And they hear that Peter has gone there and there's no body there, just some grave clothes. And for them, none of that represents even so much as a glimmer of hope. You'd have thought they might seize eagerly on any little scraps. Like when that submersible was missing at the Titanic site last summer. And some banging sounds were heard at one point beneath the water. Perhaps that's them, everyone said. Perhaps they're alive. But these guys aren't reacting like that to these pieces of evidence that they have. They aren't saying, perhaps it's him. Perhaps he's alive. I mean, Cleopas and his companion don't even feel it's worth staying on in Jerusalem any longer. Not even just on the off chance that there might be something in the women's report. Something in Peter's discovery of an empty tomb. Puh, is their response to those developments. None of that makes any difference. It's all over. Jesus is dead and we're off home to Emmaus. These are not naive and gullible people. Whatever you might say about them, they are not naive and gullible people. These are realistic, hard-headed people. People who will accept one piece of evidence alone as being of any validity. And that is Jesus actually appearing physically in their very presence. And Jesus does appear then. And that then is the decisive incident to which my heading refers. The decisive incident that changes everything. They couldn't argue with an appearing. They could argue with what the women had experienced that morning. Well, their sense of reality was probably distorted because they were emotional. They could argue with the tomb being empty when Peter turned up at it. Well, there must have been some interference with the tomb. But they couldn't argue with Jesus actually appearing to somebody. I kind of feel a bit sorry for these women. I hope the disciples later apologized to them, bought them some flowers or something. But at the same time, I'm quite glad for the disciples' cynicism. Because I know I can believe men like this. I know I can believe men who were so wary of seizing the idea of Jesus' resurrection, even when they had some pretty good evidence of it. I know I can believe men whose bar of proof was so high. And I want to say to you, you can believe those men as well. You can believe them. Believing in Jesus' resurrection is not intellectual suicide. It's not accepting the testimony of a bunch of undiscerning numpties. It's accepting the testimony of men who resisted Jesus' resurrection and resisted Jesus' resurrection and resisted Jesus' resurrection until they were compelled to recognize it because they now had overwhelming evidence they could no longer argue against. I'm happy to believe men like that. And I hope you will take very seriously this morning the testimony of men like that. The decisive incident. But then notice with me, secondly, the disgraced individual. The disgraced individual. So what is this appearance that Jesus has made that has now persuaded them that he has risen from the dead? Well, what do they say in our text? The Lord has risen indeed and has appeared to Simon. They mean Simon Peter, one of the disciples. He has appeared to Simon. Simon of all people. Why do I say that? Why Simon of all people? Well, because at some point, very late on Thursday evening, or possibly very early on Friday morning, this man, Simon Peter, had messed up big time. He had denied, in the face of a wee bit of pressure, he had denied three times that he had anything to do with Jesus, that he had any knowledge of Jesus, that there was any connection at all between the two of them. This, the man who had accompanied Jesus for 3 years, who had been Jesus' best friend, we might almost say, for 3 years. And on that Thursday night, Friday morning, he had denied all knowledge of Jesus. He had messed up big time. And here we are then. And it's what, about 48 hours later. And Jesus has risen from the dead. And the first of his disciples that he makes a beeline for is who? It's this man, Peter. We don't know where this appearance took place. We don't know exactly how it unfolded, but it must have been then at some point between Cleopas and his companion leaving Jerusalem for Emmaus and Cleopas and his companion returning from Emmaus to Jerusalem. At some point during those hours, Jesus had appeared to Peter. You would have thought, wouldn't you, that after what had happened, Jesus would not want anything more to do with this man, Peter. At the very least, you'd have thought he might want to give Peter a long period of awkwardness. When he was appearing to all the other disciples and having great fun with them, but Peter was being left out. And Peter was in the cold. And Peter wasn't seeing anything of Jesus. So that Peter didn't really know where he stood exactly and whether there was any future for him as a disciple or what. You'd have thought Jesus might have let that happen. A long, long spell of tension and awkwardness. But no. No. Peter's not the last of the disciples to be appeared to. He's not even in the middle of the group to be appeared to. He's the first to be appeared to, as Paul himself confirms in that passage with which we began our service this morning. Why then? Why does Jesus, having risen from the dead, appear to Peter of all people? Well, I think actually, when you understand the bigger picture of what's going on this weekend in Jerusalem, actually it's highly appropriate that Jesus should appear first to Peter. Because why did Jesus die on that cross on Good Friday? Well, this is why. He died in order to pay for people's sins in order that they can be forgiven. That's a simple one-sentence summary of what Jesus was doing, dying on that cross. He died in order to pay for people's sins so that they can be forgiven. Imagine a chemist who goes off and locks himself into his lab for several weeks on end. And eventually he comes out of his lab saying, I've invented a sun cream that is totally effective. Apply it once and there will be 100% protection without its effects ever waning at all. And I have booked a plane to the Sahara Desert where I'm going to give it a run out. Well, you might think, hang on a minute, mate. Why not go to the south of England first? I mean, it's pretty sunny there. Why not try it there? But no, this man, he's produced an awesome sun cream, and so he is going to head to where that sun cream is most needed. And Jesus is a bit like that here. On the cross on Friday, he has produced an awesome forgiveness. And so now, on this Sunday, he heads to where it's most conspicuously needed, to the man who was messed up big time 48 hours earlier. Jesus now has, through his bloody sacrifice, exactly what such a man needs. He has forgiveness for precisely the kind of mess up that Peter has made. And so, as I say, it's appropriate actually. It's appropriate that of all people he should go for the one who is up to his eyes in sin and guilt at this point. Because Jesus has just done something for people who are up to their eyes in sin and guilt. Now, let me be clear. We all need forgiveness. If we're going to be safe on the day that we finally stand before the God who made us, we all need forgiveness. If we are going to avoid hell and gain heaven, we all need forgiveness. Some of you may think this morning that you are above the need of forgiveness. You're too good to need forgiving. You're leading a great life. I need to tell you that's not the case. You need it. I want to say to you, you must go to Jesus. But others of you this morning may not think that you're above the need of forgiveness. You may think that you're beneath the possibility of forgiveness. You're too bad to receive it. You've lived a terrible life. You've had so many shameful episodes where you've gone off the rails and you've been wild and excessive in debauchery. Well, I want to say to you, that's not the case either. I want to say to you that you can go to Jesus. His forgiveness, the forgiveness that he secured on Calvary's cross, it's not merely for respectable, moderate sinners. It's for extravagant sinners, excessive sinners, wild sinners, raving sinners, people who have really blown it, like Peter had really blown it. Jesus loves to forgive them. And so he made a beeline here for the most disreputable at that moment of all his disciples. He made a beeline for Peter. And he will make a beeline for you as soon as you cry out to him, Jesus, please forgive me. I've lived a wretched life. I've done such ugly things. I've left a trail of chaos and devastation wherever I've been. But Jesus, forgive me. He will make the beeline for you that he made for Simon Peter. He can. He's got something for you. He secured something on that cross that will deal with all your sins, all that you've messed up, all that you've done wrong. He secured a forgiveness that will cure anybody. Anybody. So this morning, don't feel certainly that you're above the need of forgiveness, but don't feel either that you're beneath the possibility of forgiveness. Whoever you are, go to him this morning. Go to him and say, Jesus, you died on the cross to secure forgiveness. Please forgive me so that I will be safe when I stand before God. The decisive incident, the disgraced individual. But then thirdly and finally this morning, the dramatic implication. The dramatic implication. There's one bit of our text of this line that the disciples are saying that we haven't yet touched on. They don't just say, Jesus has risen indeed and has appeared to Simon. They say, the Lord has risen indeed. The Lord has risen. It's an interesting contrast, isn't it, with Cleopas and his companion in that conversation they have with the stranger. They don't know who he is. They're on the road to Emmaus. And they refer in verse 19 to Jesus of Nazareth. That's what they call him, Jesus of Nazareth. And they say that they're sure he was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people. And of course, a prophet, that's quite a status. A prophet is not someone to be sniffed at. That's pretty impressive. But it's not unique, is it? If Jesus was a prophet, it puts him in the same category as Moses and Elisha and Daniel. But you see here now in verse 34, now they're not referring to him as merely Jesus of Nazareth. Now they're not saying that our prophet has risen indeed. Now they're saying the Lord has risen. Why this title now? Well, because Jesus has just taken on death and has won. Someone who does that is not merely a prophet. Moses didn't do that. Elisha didn't do that. Daniel didn't do that. Death got the better of them just as it gets the better of all of us. No one can beat death. It gets the better of everyone, doesn't it? The greatest rulers in this world, the greatest film stars in this world, the greatest footballers in this world, those who earn the most money, who achieve the most celebrity status, none of them can beat death. We can defer it a bit and extend the average lifespan with our medicine and our technology. We can make it a bit less painful with our drugs, but we can't beat it. Jesus did. Jesus beat it. This is a power. This is an authority. This is a mastery that the world had never seen before him and has never seen since him. Truly, this is the Lord. They're right. This is the Lord. The Lord to whom all of us must bow and surrender our lives or face devastating consequences. I mean, if death could not get the better of Jesus, you can be sure that you won't get the better of him. And so to ignore and defy one who has the power to give the grave its comeuppance, that is an extremely dangerous path to take. But anyway, why wouldn't you want this Lord? And I know I said virtually the same thing on Friday, but it's worth saying again. Why wouldn't you want this Lord? It's foolishly dangerous to ignore and defy someone who's so great, but why wouldn't you want him anyway? I mean, if you are on his side, then you need not fear anything. Not even death. Not even death. Having given the grave its comeuppance on Easter Sunday morning, Jesus has shown that he can do that and that he can one day therefore do it again. And he is going to do it again. On the last day, at the end of history, he's going to give the grave its comeuppance once more, as this time he doesn't exit it himself because he's already come out of it, but this time he brings out of it all who have followed him and all who have trusted in him. That's what Jesus is going to do. That's what he promises to do. No one else promises that. People promise all sorts of things in this world, but no one in their right mind promises, I will bring you out of death one day. Jesus promises that, and it's a credible promise because he came out of death himself. He's Lord over death. He's Lord over death. Death must comply with Jesus' wishes. Death must obey Jesus' command. Whomever Jesus on that last day orders death to hand over to him, death will have to hand that person over to him. It's a wonderful thing then. A wonderful thing to be a Christian. And to be able to say this morning, my friend Jesus has death under his control. My friend Jesus has death at his beck and call. And he will not allow me to stay in its grip forever. He will rescue me. He will come for me. He will take me out of there. There's nothing better than being able to say that. And so I urge you as I close this morning, become the kind of person who can say that. Become a Christian. Become a believer in Jesus Christ. Many of us in this room are that. The Jesus into whose hands we have committed ourselves, soul and body, is the Lord. The Lord over every danger, over every threat, even over death itself. That's the dramatic implication of what happened on Easter Sunday morning. Jesus is Lord over death. Bow before this mighty Lord and receive this mighty Lord as your Lord so that you will be safe when death comes and gets you. Come this morning. to the one of whom it was once said, "The Lord has risen indeed." Amen. Amen.